The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
The following communique has just been issued by Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
People of Western Europe, the hour of your liberation is approaching. All patriots, men and women, young and old, have a part to play in the achievement of final victory. This landing is but the opening phase of the campaign in Western Europe. Great battles lie ahead. I call upon all who love freedom to stand with us now. Keep your faith staunch. Our arms are resolute. Together we shall achieve victory.
Today is the 73rd anniversary of the Normandy landings, that last bit there. That was General Eisenhower talking about the victory that would come, and it did. Today I'd like to build the show around some of the research and study that we put in leading up to our visit to Normandy yesterday. It was brief, but meaningful. We were able to see the American cemetery near Omaha Beach. And then also the beach itself, of course, and quite a lot going on, given that today's the anniversary. There were quite a few events and presentations and things going on around Overlord Museum and just throughout the area there. So it was, in one sense, as my wife was telling me, it was nice to just see so many people there because of how many have forgotten this important history. And as I say, I'll build the show around just some of the takeaways that I think are important to bring out from some of this history, some of this research that we've put in. I'll get to that in just a second. But first, thanks to those who filled in for me on Friday. Richard Palmer talked more about just the relationship or the severing relationship between Donald Trump's administration and NATO and Europe in particular. And speaking with Richard this morning, too, we're going to be putting together some of that material from last week. I know I spent a fair bit of time on it on several programs, and then he followed up with that on Friday as well. So we'll hope to write up some of that material and have it at the website and possibly in the Trumpet magazine in the near future as well. Yesterday, Brad McDonald sat in and talked, I think the last time he subbed for me, it was the day following the attack in Manchester. And so here he was again in the hot seat as there was much to say or much to talk about regarding another terrorist attack in London this time. His program yesterday, the London attack exposes Britain's fundamental problem, and that show, like Richard's, is posted at thetrumpet.com. If you didn't get a chance to listen to those programs, you can, as always, listen to the podcasts at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. Well, regarding our visit, our brief visit to Normandy yesterday, this is a site that really I've wanted to see ever since I was a teenager. And some of the things that really stood out to me, Omaha Beach is the widest of the five. There were two beaches that the British took and one that the Canadians took and then two that the Americans took. And Omaha Beach is perhaps the most famous because of how difficult it was to overtake the Germans at that location. But that beach itself is 10 miles wide. I think all five beaches together, some 50 miles or so, that the Allies stormed back on June 6th, 1944, Following General Eisenhower's order, there were something like 6,000 landing craft, ships, and other vessels that were carrying almost 200,000 troops. They left for France. They left from England for France. It was kind of interesting. Just last night, we left Cherbourg, the port. It was a longer ferry ride than we usually take at the narrowest point in the English Channel, Calais over to Dover. But this was a wider point, more toward the mouth of the channel there that goes on into the ocean, and the sea was quite a bit more choppy, and it was a longer ferry ride. Of course, we were going in the opposite direction that the troops would have been going in 73 years ago, but it was hard not to think about that that night. They landed on those beaches at 6:30 in the morning, and however long, I didn't do the research on this particular point, but they had to have left England in the middle of the night, heading there and just in these choppy waves and so on. And there was quite a bit of trouble that the soldiers had with seasickness, and then coming upon those beaches early in the morning and with thousands and thousands of landing craft. And of course, all of the aircraft as well that had been going on through the night to drop all of the paratroopers and to bomb some of the critical passageways to prevent the Germans from sending in reinforcements. I mean, it's often, I guess we kind of think about it, what the Allies encountered when they set foot on those beaches. But I was finding myself wondering about what the Germans must have thought. Seeing thousands of ships as the sun came up that day, seeing thousands of ships and tens of thousands of soldiers coming up those beaches. There was a movie, I think, back in the 1960s entitled The Longest Day. I mean, it was a long day when you take into account the travel through the night and then the 12 hours or so, in the case of Omaha anyway, that it took to take that particular territory. And that was the beginning of the liberation of Europe. And really, soon after that, it didn't take very long. It was less than a year when Hitler had finally been defeated. That was the beginning, though, of the victory, the beginning of the end for Adolf Hitler. And, of course, it came with a heavy price. As so many people know, we visited the American cemetery. There's 9,387 graves at that massive, massive site. And there's another 1,557 names inscribed on a memorial there of those that went missing. So 10,000 or so. It's almost like a sacred ground. Quite a few visitors, fairly quiet most of the time that we were there. And then just this sea of crosses and stars of David, almost 10,000 of them. A very moving experience if you haven't seen one. I've seen an American cemetery in the Philippines as well. I think there's something like 14 of them around the world. But there they are, advancing freedom. Or there they were in 1944, fighting for liberty. There were, as I said at the top, quite a few things that stood out to me. One, following this almost sacred feel to that ground, 170 acres or so, just the reverence and the honor that was given to God and the Holy Bible. I mean, you walk around this cemetery and some of the inscriptions that you see. One here, this says, "This embattled shore, portal of freedom, is forever hallowed by the ideals, the valor, and the sacrifices of our fellow countrymen." That's there at the cemetery. And right in the middle of the cemetery, by the way, there's this circular chapel. It's right in the middle of all of the crosses and the Stars of David. And you walk inside this chapel. It's a fairly small facility, just with, I think, three or four benches. But inscribed on the wall, it says, "Through the gate of death, may they pass to their joyful resurrection." A reference there to the resurrection. And, of course, those men, those young men, will be resurrected. They will be brought back to life. Again, you can walk all over that ground and see references to God. And even in this case, as I just read to you, the resurrection from the dead. Those crosses, by the way, where they didn't know the identity of the individual that was there buried. It just, I mean, all the others, of course, it has the name, when they died, and so on. But for the unknown soldier, it says, "Here rests in honored glory a comrade in arms, known but to God." Only God knows who he is. And he'll be resurrected, as it says inside that circular chapel. Well, when you think about just the spirit of that age in Great Britain, in the United States, it's only been 73 years. 73 years, and look at how different our society is. Look at how different the leaders are today. I want to play for you some clips. This is coming from the King of England, King George the VI, and his address to the British people, to the British subjects all over the world. This was his address on D-Day, June 6th, 1944, clip one.
"That we may be worthily matched with this new summons of destiny, I desire solemnly to call my people to prayer and dedication. We shall ask not that God may do our will, but that we may be enabled to do the will of God. And we dare to believe that God has used our nation and empire as an instrument for fulfilling his high purpose."
Pretty inspiring words. Hopefully you can make all of them out. But that was the King of Britain calling upon his people to pray and to dedicate their lives to God, to ask that, not that God would do our will, but that we might fulfill the will of God. And then he mentions the empire being used as an instrument for God's purposes. To fulfill God's purpose, his high purpose. Are you going to hear anyone in the royal family today talking like this? Calling upon the people of Britain following a terrorist atrocity, let's say. Calling upon the people of Britain to dedicate themselves to the God of this universe? Inspiring words. That was the tone. That was the national tone in Britain. The tone of the empire. Humbling ourselves before God. Crying out to God for his deliverance. Or for him to deliver us in this time of trial and test. This is from the same address. Here's what, again, the British king had to say. Clip two.
"I hope that throughout the present crisis of the liberation of Europe, there may be offered up earnest, continuous, and widespread prayer. We who remain in this land can most effectively enter into the sufferings of subjugated Europe by prayer, whereby we can fortify the determination of our sailors, soldiers, and airmen who go forth to set the captives free. The Queen joins with me in sending you this message. She well understands the anxieties and cares of our women folk at this time. And she knows that many of them will find, as she does herself, fresh strength and comfort in such waiting upon God. She feels that many women will be glad in this way to keep vigil with their men as they man the ships, storm the beaches, and fill the skies.
That's King George from 1944 talking about the crisis of the liberation of Europe, and that we might offer up earnest, continuous, and widespread prayer. Earnest and continuous prayer to God. And the Queen, well, she joins me in this message. She understands the desires and the cares of our women today. And our women should also get involved in waiting on God, in keeping this vigil with their men, as these men of Britain on those ships, on those landing crafts, storm the beaches, or in the case of the paratroopers, fill the skies, thousands upon thousands of them, tens of thousands at the beaches. Everyone needed to get involved. It reminds you of some passages in the Old Testament where God said, look, I mean, the father leads the way, of course, but the mother, the children, everyone, it's a family operation. We're all involved. And King George went on to bring that out, that look, nobody is exempt from this. Here's the final clip from that speech, clip 3.
At this historic moment, surely, not one of us is too busy, too young, or too old to play a part in a nationwide, a worldwide vigil of prayer as the great crusade set forth. If from every place of worship, from home and factory, from men and women of all ages and many races and occupations, our intercessions rise, then, please God, both now and in the future, not remote, the predictions of an ancient psalm may be fulfilled. The Lord will give strength unto his people. The Lord will give his people the blessing of peace.
If everyone gets involved, if the whole nation offers up prayers to God, a solemn appeal to God, if all people of all ages and any race, occupation, it doesn't matter, if we intercede, we all, in other words, we all have a part in this. It's not just the 175,000 aboard all of those ships and landing crafts. The whole nation is part of this effort. The whole nation is fighting for freedom. The whole nation has to draw close to God. That's how we win this. That's how this becomes a success. Let me read to you what it says in the book of Deuteronomy. This is Deuteronomy chapter 20. In verse 1, it says, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and a people more than you, be not afraid. Be not afraid of them, God says, for the Lord your God is with you. which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. I mean, this is how you win wars, God says. Verse 2, it says, and it shall be, when you are come near unto the battle, that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people, and shall say to them, hear, O Israel, you approach this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint. Fear not, and do not tremble, neither be you terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goes with you to fight for you against your enemies and to save you. That's what the leaders in the end time nations of Israel were saying to the people of Britain and America back at that time, just 73 years ago, that God has to be with us, that God has to be leading this charge. If not, we're in trouble. I mean, this wasn't that long ago. That's the thing. As I say, you walk through these museums, you walk through these cemeteries, and carved into the stone are messages based on the Bible, even about the future resurrection of these dead bones. You think about the Valley of Dry Bones in Ezekiel's prophecy. They're going to be brought back to life. They're dead and buried now, but they have an opportunity. They will have an opportunity. And same for those Germans that died in battle. Well, that was King George, and it was the same on the other side of the Atlantic. It was the same message coming from a U.S. president, a Democrat, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We've played this particular prayer before on this program, I think a couple, 3 months ago. It's about 3 minutes in length. But listen to this. This is from the President of the United States. It's his prayer on the day of the Normandy landings. This is clip 4.
Last night, when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment the troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. And let our hearts be stout to wait out the long travel, to bear sorrows that may come, to impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. A peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
That was a prayer by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President Roosevelt. His D-Day prayer from 1944, not that long ago, 73 years. I mean, my own father was 9 years old at the time of the Normandy landings. He was alive at that time. You're talking two, maybe three generations ago. A president of the United States calling upon God to give our people victory, to give our sons strength, to lead them straight and true, to give all the rest of us faith. We all have a part in this, just like the King of England said, just like the King of the British Empire brought out. And with God's blessing, we will prevail. He said, just like King George, thy will be done. Very similar to what the King of Great Britain had said. We're not praying that you fulfill our will. We're praying that your will be done. And well, that was just the beginning. D-Day, June 6th, 1944. 175,000 or so troops landing on those beaches, establishing a strong Allied presence, finally, in France, in Europe, to begin the process of liberating the continent. And as I say, after that, we'll get into some of the other takeaways from the Normandy landings when we come back. These things that really you and everyone should know about D-Day. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Perhaps no hour in Britain's history was darker than that preceding World War II. Nazi Germany was arming. Nations in Europe were being conquered, their borders redrawn. Britain, the nation that once ruled one quarter of the earth, teetered on the edge of survival. Many leaders in Britain feared war. They wanted to disarm. They spoke of peace as Europe sank deeper into the pit of war. This dark hour may have been Britain's last, were it not for one man. This man stood alone in the face of adversity at home and abroad. He rose to the occasion when his nation needed him most. He vowed that Britain would never surrender when confronted by forces of evil. Winston Churchill took Britain's most important job during Britain's darkest hour. He did what others were afraid to do. Some doubted his methods, but the results speak for themselves. Churchill led Britain from the precipice of ignominious defeat and possible death to what became one of the nation's brightest hours. What was it that made Winston Churchill so different from other leaders of his time? Surely now, more than ever, this world needs another Winston Churchill. Our booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, explains what made this man such a great leader. We would like to offer this booklet to you free of charge. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
40 summers have passed since the battle that you fought here. You were young the day you took these cliffs. Some of you were hardly more than boys with the deepest joys of life before you. Yet you risked everything here. Why? Why did you do it? Well, what impelled you to put aside the instinct for self-preservation and risk your lives to take these cliffs? What inspired all the men of the armies that met here? We look at you and somehow we know the answer. It was faith and belief. It was loyalty and love. The men of Normandy had faith that what they were doing was right, faith that they fought for all humanity, faith that a just God would grant them mercy on this beachhead or on the next. It was the deep knowledge, and pray God we have not lost it, that there is a profound moral difference between the use of force for liberation and the use of force for conquest. You were here to liberate, not to conquer, and so you and those others did not doubt your cause, and you were right not to doubt. You all knew that some things are worth dying for. One's country is worth dying for, and democracy is worth dying for because it's the most deeply honorable form of government ever devised by man.
That's one of my favorite speeches from President Ronald Reagan. He was speaking there at Normandy on June 6, 1984, at the 40-year anniversary. And today, of course, we're at the 73rd anniversary of the Normandy landings. That certainly is another takeaway from this history, this event that changed the course of history. The fact that you, in any way that you study this, you see a level of sacrifice and courage right across the board throughout the United States and Great Britain that you just simply don't see today. Now, certainly there are military men still in our midst that are certainly courageous and bold, but the spirit of these, by the tens of thousands, willing to risk everything. And I think President Reagan really did zero in on why they did it. And it goes back to what I covered in the first segment. Just the honor that was given to God and His Word, the reverence toward God, prayers of faith. President Reagan said it was faith and belief, it was loyalty and love, just knowing that some things are worth dying for, knowing that God would grant those men mercy on that beachhead, or on the next, as he put it. This deep knowledge, he said, I pray God that we've not lost it. I pray that we've not lost this faith, this belief, this loyalty, this love. Well, I'd say that we've lost nearly all of it. What a difference when you compare this God-centered approach to warfare and fighting an enemy that wants to destroy you. I mean, as I say, you visit that site as I did yesterday, and you just see the immensity of this operation, just how massive it was and how the United States was late coming in for sure, but then quite happy to step forward and to lead in this operation. And as soon as there was a clearing in the weather, and I'll get into that in just a second as well, General Eisenhower gave the go-ahead, and everything was in motion. That's yet another thing that we need to know about D-Day. The fact that it was a miracle from God that made it such a success. And this is something that's not, it's not often brought out in the history covered today, the history written about today, or the history written today about that event, D-Day from 1944. But back at that time, there was a widespread awareness among political leaders, military men, members of the media, that God, in fact, did intervene. That God did lead the way. This is from General Eisenhower himself. I mean, the original, or rather the date for D-Day, it was scheduled for June the 5th, the day before. But the weather was too bad, and the weather had been bad all summer. This is from General Eisenhower. It says, the final conference for determining the feasibility of attacking on June 5th, he just talks about how the low clouds and the high winds and all that, it would have made it a disaster. But it says here, at 3:30 the next morning, our little tent was shaking and shuddering under a wind of almost hurricane proportions. This would have been the morning of June 5th. It seemed impossible that in such conditions there was any reason for even discussing the situation. Bad conditions predicted the day before the coast of France were actually prevailing there, and if we had persisted in the attempt to land on June 5th, a major disaster would have almost surely have resulted. And then he talks about how the meteorological staff told us to inspire more confidence in their next astonishing declaration, which was that by the following morning, this would have been June 6th, a period of relatively good weather, heretofore completely unexpected, would ensue, lasting probably 36 hours. So they had a short window of opportunity. The long-term prediction was not good, but this short period of calm, it says, this short period of calm weather would intervene between the storm we were then experiencing and the beginning of the next spell of bad weather. And so it says, this is again General Eisenhower, he writes, I quickly announced the decision to go ahead with the attack on June the 6th. And this caught the Germans completely by surprise. For one, I mean, they were expecting an attack at the narrowest point of the channel, there between Dover and Calais. And they weren't expecting it at this time anywhere because the weather was so bad. Rommel was in Berlin visiting his wife. He wasn't even around. Hitler didn't expect it. But here's this 36-hour window, this miracle from God. This is what it said in the Daily Telegraph. This is 1947 now. You're not going to see this kind of an article in 2017, but you go back 70 years or so, and it's common. It's common. This is a piece by Lieutenant General Sir Frederick Morgan. He talks about not just D-Day, but all the miracles that happen. Dunkirk, how did that happen? Who planned that? Saving the British forces. There was Dunkirk and its fiat, calm sea, it says. Who planned it? Later on, the history of our other theaters of war will inevitably tell of many similar happenings, but I doubt if any will be such as to compare with the miracle of D-Day. In 1944, there had already been one short delay caused by bad weather, which meant that any further postponement must have been of weeks to await the right conjunction of light and tide. There was something more than ordinary, surely, in that decision to attack and in that spirit of success that permeated the ranks. A miracle from God. Here's another one, the Times of London. This is from September 1944, so a couple of months after D-Day. It says here, it seemed that those normally placid and sunlit days when May and June mingle were this summer malignantly possessed, and yet all the time, had we but known it, the clouds we so much dreaded were big with opportunities. Supreme Headquarters were quick to grasp. It says the German commanders were advised by their meteorological service that there could be no invasion in the period including June 6 because of continuous stormy weather. That's why D-Day forces landing during a brief break in the windiest month in Normandy for at least 20 years found so many German troops without officers, and why other enemy coastal units were having exercises at the time of the landing. They weren't expecting it at all because of how stormy the weather had been for an entire month. The Times commenting again. This is now from October of 1944. This is the Times of London. Writing in 1944, it has perhaps never been fully appreciated how near the invasion forces came to disaster comparable with the fate of the Spanish Armada. I mean, this is an armada that could have just been wiped out if the weather wouldn't cooperate, if God didn't intervene. Years later, not that many years, 1952, so 8 years later, General Eisenhower, who led the expedition, this is according to Time magazine, he said, this is at his hometown of Abilene, Kansas, he's writing or speaking on the anniversary, the eight-year anniversary of D-Day, and he says, "This day, 8 years ago, I made the most agonizing decision of my life. If there were nothing else in my life to prove the existence of an almighty and merciful God, the events of the next 24 hours did it. The greatest break in a terrible outlay of weather occurred the next day and allowed that great invasion to proceed with losses far below those we had anticipated." So you watch the documentaries or the Hollywood movies today, and you think, well, boy, the losses, it was devastating. I'll come more to this here in just a second. But in fact, they were expecting much more in the way of losses. Field Marshal Montgomery, the British general, he said, "Such an historic march of events can seldom have taken place in such a short space of time. Let us to each other say... Let us say this, this was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Let's conclude this," Field Marshal Montgomery said, following D-Day. This was God's doing. The many miracles, that's another thing that you should know about D-Day, really, it's the untold story. God's miraculous intervention. And you see, too, where all of these takeaways, they're connected, aren't they? The miracles from God, the trust in God, the level of sacrifice and courage because of faith in God, faith in a cause. What else can we take away from this important history? What are the lessons? Well, as miraculous as it was, God's intervention in the weather and other things, another important lesson to take away from all of this is that this war, some 60 million casualties dead as a result of this world war, it was completely and totally unnecessary. The truth of the matter is that those tens of thousands of troops shouldn't have had to cross that channel the night of June 6th, 1944. Not if the leaders of the West would have stood up to Hitler early on, before Austria, before Czechoslovakia. As it is, they didn't stand up to him. They were firm believers in the policy of appeasement. My father wrote a piece, by the way, back in 2002 about World War II being the unnecessary war. He quotes Lloyd George in there. He was the Prime Minister of Britain in World War I. And he, during the 1930s, I think it was 1935, he was praising Hitler. Hitler's, I mean, he's the greatest German leader of his age. There's quite a few people in London's West End. Brad McDonald's brought this out before as well, who really thought Hitler was pretty pretty amazing and wanted to even dress like him and comb their hair like him. And as you can imagine, Winston Churchill was just, he was just appalled by this kind of thinking. Churchill wrote this, "I feel our country's safety is fatally imperiled both by its lack of arms and by the government's attitude towards the Nazi gangsters. It is fostering in them the dangerous belief that they need not fear interference by us, whatever they do. That can only encourage those savages to acts of aggression and violence of every kind." We're only encouraging the savages with this kind of behavior. And so as awesome as those prayers and those speeches and all of those messages carved in stone are, at that moment of crisis, turning to God, looking to God for deliverance, looking to God for miracles, here again, the truth of the matter is that our people weren't looking to God for guidance and direction before the storm hit. They weren't looking to God. They were instead trusting in human reasoning, thinking that the Nazis could be negotiated with. The Times, as great as that piece was that I just read to you about the miracles, Churchill really did. He really did condemn the Times for its reporting in the 1930s, suggesting that Czechoslovakia should make some concessions to Germany. Well, you know, maybe you should go ahead and concede this and this and this to satisfy Hitler. To make sure, you know, he's not upset. Well, as we know now, and it should have been obvious then, but as we now know, I mean, as soon as Hitler got what he demanded, then he just went on and demanded more. It was never enough. And so then you go 5-10 years forward in the story, and here Hitler pretty much controls the entirety of the European continent. Of course, Russia was pushing in from the east. And Hitler desperately wanted to avoid having to battle on two fronts. And so that's why he was creating this wall of resistance all along France, Belgium, and so on, to prevent the Allies from establishing a beachhead. But June 6th, 175,000 boys going across those treacherous waters, arriving early in the hours, early in the morning on June 6th, and all the casualties and the suffering that resulted from these policies of appeasement that had gone on and on and on for years in the lead up to World War II. That's an important takeaway for sure. Another takeaway, another something you should know about D-Day, about the Normandy landings, is that this represented a tremendous victory for the United States, for Great Britain, for the Allied forces, for Canada. A tremendous victory. Last week, I, in preparation for the visit, I watched this documentary, which on the one hand was really interesting. It talked about some of the equipment, the strategy, and so on. But on the other hand, I was just kind of stunned, following the documentary and just doing some more reading. I mean, you watch the documentary and you come away from it thinking, wow, I mean, so many things went wrong for the Allies. So many things went wrong for the United States. I mean, with the seasickness and people that were drowning because they were sick or they fell off the side of the landing craft or the paratroopers came into swamped lands and drowned there because their buckles weren't right or whatever it was. But then you step back and you look at this one day, the longest day for sure. But this massive showing of force on the part of Ephraim and Manasseh and the United States of America, quite happy to take the lead and to make the sacrifices needed to conquer this foe. Hitler's forces were, as I said, in control of most of the mainland of Europe. This was the critical point, the turning point. I mean, once you successfully invade that continent, considering the pressure coming on Hitler's forces from the east, that's what needed to be done to win this war. This is from history.com. It says, on the morning of June 5th, Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander, gave the go-ahead to Operation Overlord, the largest amphibious military operation in history. There's never been anything like this in history. There's never been anything like this since. On his orders, 6,000 landing craft, ships, and other vessels carrying 176,000 troops began to leave England for a trip to France. For the trip to France. That night, 822 aircraft filled with parachutists headed for drop zones in Normandy. An additional 13,000 aircraft were mobilized to provide air cover and support for the invasion. By dawn on June 6th, 18,000 parachutists were already on the ground. I think some 36 of them died in the swampland that the Germans had created. 36. I mean, as tragic as that is, 36 out of 18,000. And yet that was a crucial point brought out by this documentary that I watched last week. It says the British and Canadians overcame light opposition to capture Gold, Juno, and Sword beaches. You don't hear much about those beaches, because the Allies just pretty much walked right on in. So did the Americans at Utah Beach. The task was much tougher at Omaha, however, where 2,000 troops were lost, and it was only through the tenacity and quick-wittedness of troops on the ground that the objective was achieved. By day's end, by one day, the end of one day, it says 155,000 Allied troops, Americans, British, and Canadians, had successfully stormed Normandy's beaches. What a tremendous victory! It says, for their part, the Germans suffered from confusion in the ranks and the absence of celebrated commander Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, who was away on leave. At first, Hitler, believing that the invasion was a feint designed to distract the Germans from a coming attack north of the Seine River, refused to release nearby divisions to join the counterattack, and reinforcements had to be called from further afield, causing delays. Hitler also hesitated in calling for armored divisions to help in the defense. In addition, the Germans were hampered by effective Allied air support, which took out many key bridges and forced the Germans to take long detours, as well as efficient Allied naval support, which helped protect advancing Allied troops. I mean, this was a tremendous, tremendous victory, which our modern historians are not as quick to point out. But that also brings the question, where are these victories, these tremendous victories today? Because if you were to produce documentaries about the wars since World War II, I mean, then they would rightfully be pretty negative in the tone. Why is everything going wrong? Why haven't we won a war decisively like this since? There's an article just today in the USA Today, Remembering D-Day, when America was willing to lead. Where is the American leadership today? Where is the showing of power and force, overwhelming power and force, coming from the United States and Britain? Well, I mean, if you haven't read or studied it yet, the United States and Britain in prophecy is where to go, because it tells you why those victories, we're not obtaining them anymore. There's lots and lots of other lessons, I'm sure, that you could take away from D-Day and the Normandy landings. But those are some that we've been thinking about around here over the past many days. And perhaps in the weeks ahead, I can dig into it a little bit more. There certainly is a lot that can be said about the Normandy landings. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Excuse me. And we'll see you tomorrow.